There needs to be a debt jubilee. The Bible, you know, speaks about that, Leviticus 25. And it was a jubilee to let the land have a rest every 50 years, I guess, right? And that, so that's kind of what they're calling this, a debt forgiveness. Look, 12 zeros, $1 trillion, you can never repay this debt. It can never be done. We cannot grow ourselves out of this this hole we're in. You know, Will Rogers once said, when you find yourself in a hole, you should quit digging.
Of the Sharpener Report. I am your host, Sam Johnston. We are found at YouTube, iTunes, Blog Talk, and you can follow me at Twitter at Sam T. Johnston. This is the part of the show where most hosts would ask you to subscribe and hit the bell. Well, we now live in a world where more people believe in UFOs than believe that Social Security can actually fulfill its obligations. And it is so hard to understand our large economy because there are so many different moving pieces most people can't wrap their heads around. The tax that we pay every year, which is understandable because there's over 74,000 pages to the US tax code and it's confusing. So we need to dive into it because it is such an important topic that affects our day-to-day lives and, equally as important, is going to affect our lives very drastically in the future. And joining us today to talk about the economy in many different facets is the author of America's Financial Reckoning Day, Mr. Chuck Kappas. He is the founder and president of IDP Consulting, which deals with precious metals. He's been on numerous different radio shows and is very well educated in terms of the economy. So, Chuck, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to be with you, Sam. And welcome. Thanks for the opportunity here.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect time to talk about the economy with the 4th of July rolling around, isn't it?
Yeah, I was thinking about that as we tape this week, 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence. It should be really the Declaration of Dependence. You just talked about demographics and everything else, entitlements. Almost half, more than half the American people are getting direct aid from the government and so on, you know, transfer payments. So these are, that's just a major trend that can't be sustained either. And, you know, it's the contrast between collectivism versus individualism.
Absolutely.
And, right. And so anyway, that's where I see things going is pretty critical. And we need to get into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get too much into that, can you give us a little bit of background on who you are and where you come from?
Yeah, I've been in the precious metals business for 25 years, independent for about 15 now, consulting firm, and help people with precious metal depository accounts, IRAs, and physical delivery, and so on. So, by virtue of being in this business, you run up in contrast to the corrupt banking cartels and the fiat currency and everything else that they've created, which I go over in my book, the first part of it, anyway. So that's how I fell into this business. I don't know. I became a Christian 39 years ago, and the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. And that's what it is. You know, we need constitutional money. Article 1, Section 10, you know, we should only have gold and silver as legal tender. So this is the battle we're up against is, and the people's understanding, I don't know if you've ever seen that Mark Dice interview where he tried to give a gold coin to somebody or a Hershey bar in front of a gold store and they took the Hershey bar. That's just how ignorant people are about these things. And so, yeah, that's my background. Raised in Indiana. I lived in Phoenix for many years and mostly in the high country of Durango, Colorado, and Arizona here for about 20-some years. So,
perfect.
A little hot out here today, but we're going to start getting our rains, thank God.
Yeah, I'm up in Michigan, and I think it's hot, and it's like 89 degrees out. I can't even imagine what it's like over there. But you know, talking about the economy, especially how things have beginning to transform in today, as the Trump administration starts to take over, people, it's always funny to me that people point to the Dow Jones. And when it was in the Obama era, all the conservatives pointed to the Dow Jones and said, hey, it doesn't mean anything. It's useless. It's just made up numbers. But now that Trump's in office, everyone's pointing, oh, look how high it's going. It's up, you know, from 24,000. Now at one point it was at 26,000. And that's like the saving grace of our economy is what it's at. And it's just, I never understood how people can just flip a switch so quickly.
Well, it's a false metric. Let's face it. Only 10% of the wealthy class own 84% of the stocks and so on. So it's really a meaningless metric for people. And Trump was calling it a big fat bubble during the campaign, which we loved hearing, but now he owns it. Now he brags about it all the time. Look at this, look at that. And look, we haven't fixed anything since 2008. We're in worse shape. 10 years later now, we're in worse shape than we ever were. And that's why I revised my book to reflect some of these new debt figures and so on and everything. Polls indicated that people voted for Trump out of a great grave concern for their kids. In other words, the future of our country and so on. I don't have any kids, but they were really hopeful with Donald Trump. I don't think he's going to be able to pull it off. You know, I always say an optimist is one who doesn't know all the facts. So I'm always, when I get on programs like this, trying to straighten people out with the facts and figures and so on. Entitlements right now are growing at 6% annually, and our GDP is floating around 3% or less. So something's got to give here, you know.
Mm-hmm. I would say that an optimist maybe doesn't trust in the facts, but has their faith elsewhere. Believes the facts, but doesn't rely on them, if that makes sense. Especially being a Christian, I kind of tend towards being more of an optimist, I guess.
Well, trust but verify, said Reagan.
Yeah.
Hosea says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. So there's a lot of good people, you know, supporting Trump. And I tried to support him just to block Hillary Clinton. But we're on an unsustainable path. You know, 88% of our spending is fixed mandatory spending. That's nearly 90%. It wouldn't matter if George Washington or Ron Paul was in the White House, really. The way the trajectory is going. In fact, it's been institutionalized, a welfare state, a warfare state. And these are things that just are not going to go away. There's three things facing our country. It's debt, demographics, and moral hazard. And the public and private debt is over the top. McKinsey Global Institute says we've added $70 trillion in 10 years, three times the global GDP right now. The Fed has added to its balance sheet over $4 trillion in assets it can't really unload. It's kind of bluffing. And we added $1 trillion in debt just from last September to this March. Now, Sam, that's 6 months.
Yeah.
You can't continue on this path, you know. And the Fed is right now pushing on a string. Any policy they do, the central banks, they're not going to get anywhere. And a study was done by Carmen Reinhart, Kenneth Rogoff. And I'll mention him later, but they did a study, what was it called, the growth in the time of debt, and they said that any time a nation gets 90% of its debt to GDP, it has the impact is negative on long-term growth. In other words, you start doing more harm than good, right? And we're just having a very hard time keeping the status quo going here. We're at 110% probably debt to GDP. Japan's 250%. I mean, they've lost 2.5 decades. And mentioning, speaking of demographics, I'm a baby boomer, as you can tell. And we have 10,000 of my people retiring every day for the next 18 years. That's a staggering thought to think about that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I asked Social Security, I said, why? A lot of people were getting their checks on the first of the month. Why is it the third? Why are they staggering it? And they said, well, it's because there's so many people now piling on. And look, the peak earning years for baby boomers, it maxed out in 1980s. That was the decade of greed. But that's their peak earning years. And, of course, right now, Social Security is going in the red. I don't think it's going to make it. I addressed that in my book. More people believe in UFOs than they do that it'll be solvent for people like you, Sam. And our friend Steve and others, I mean, it's a ripoff. There's $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Think about that. A trillion seconds would take 32,000 years, is what they say. So these are astronomical, you know. And there was I don't think you can really reform Social Security, even though I addressed that in my book about privatizing it, you know, privatizing Medicare, giving vouchers, and so on. But that's I think it's a little bit late to be draining the fiscal swamp, frankly. And on top of that, one of my greater concerns is the pension fund crisis that's nobody is talking about very much. We don't talk about Social Security entitlements because that's the third rail of politics. Meant you step on it, you die, right? That's like that electrical railroad. But the public pensions are down about $6 trillion in all 50 states. Some are worse than others, of course. The private pension funds are in the billions, but they're still underfunded. And what's going to happen to the baby boomers? They have tied. They're chasing the yield now in the stock market to get 5%, or they're taking more risk on. And when the market collapses, if it goes down 30% or more, 50, these pension funds, they're going to start being exposed. There's going to be Chapter 9 municipal defaults. People are leaving Illinois, New Jersey, California is a basket case. And so that's a humanitarian crisis. I would say even almost of biblical proportions. The black horse in Revelation 6:5, there's no reason ever given for the amount of suffering and famine and scarcity. But something has happened to really dislocate people around the world, industrialized world, for example. And it's a pretty scary thought. I don't think we can. I don't think we're going to escape this, and I think things could happen even on Trump's watch right now. There, just one other thing, and there was a study done by Joseph Tainter some years ago, and it was called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he mainly studied Rome and so on, but he found that as a society became more complex, it took more effort to get marginal return. The cost increased while there was less marginal returns. And finally, it just debased its currency. And of course, that's what happened in Rome in the 3rd century. So we're kind of on that same trajectory, like the Reinhardt Rogoff study. There's once you get to this point, level of debt, this concentration of federal power and fiscal irresponsibility, the only way out of it is a reckoning. In fact, a reckoning means to settle accounts. It's your assets and liabilities. And we have way too many liabilities, not enough assets, certainly not enough taxpayers, the way things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. And instead of trying to correct the issue, we're going the opposite way, and we're incorporating more people into the welfare state and trying to reach more, even the younger generations to try to prop them up. And like you said in the beginning, make them more dependent on what the government has to offer. And it's really just a just it's just to gain control. And so with the debt piling up, it's like, what are you going to rely on? Are you going to rely on the promise that the government made you, or are you going to try to rely on something else, something that's more real, more something you can actually put your hands on?
Yeah, what I see happening now is it really the Cloward-Piven strategy. Have you heard about that? The Cloward-Piven strategy, that's they were Columbia University professors in the 1960s. They were writing for The Nation, which is a communist paper, and they're basically saying, let's overwhelm the welfare system, make the state live up to its promises. That's what Alinsky said, and then collapse the system, and then put in its place a collectivist society, more socialism. We just saw a millennial up in New York, win an election, and it's funny how socialists, they like to live off of capitalism, but you can't, I don't think you can get much enthusiasm for socialism right now in Venezuela, where they don't even have toilet paper. And isn't that what Bastiat said? The state is the great fiction in which everybody tries to live at the expense of everyone else.
Well, they just didn't do it right over there. That's the difference. They just done it right.
Just didn't do it right.
Yeah.
Well, and this points to moral hazard in our society. And I mean by that, people are misbehaving, irresponsible behavior. It's an insurance term, and it means people willing to take on more risk as long as they can offload it to somebody else, the cost of it, if things go badly. And we saw it in the subprime crisis. They were overrating the AAA mortgage-backed securities and so on, and moral hazard was everywhere. Everybody was just gaming, getting away with what they could. And certainly we see it in politics, which everybody's trying to game the system, even the pension funds. You know how they retire, these police chiefs and so on, and firemen, They'll save all their vacation time. You know, they're gaming the system. They put it in that last year to get their benefit when they retire. And some of these are huge. I mean, it just can't be sustained. You know, there was a sign in the national park. It says, "Don't feed the bears." Right? Feed the bears, they're going to want to come back for more.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. And you know, with John Adams, since we're near the 4th of July, one of our founding fathers, he said, "Our Constitution was made only for immoral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other kind." If you want to know why we're having culture wars and a huge moral decline, that's it. It's even more profound than our fiscal problems, really, when you look at our where we're at, you know.
Yeah. And we hear people often talk about the fact that we need to turn our country back to God, and that will solve all of our problems. But what you really laid out there was the practical application of what that does when we do turn back to God, is we stop trying to pass the blame on someone else. I mean, that's basically politics in a nutshell. Let's pass the blame onto someone else and not take any blame, which is pathetic, because we need to step up and address issues like the Social Security and the welfare state, even though it's going to make some people angry. And so, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And so, as we kind of dive more into what our economy is based off of, I know a lot of people are really involved with the petrol dollar, and that's kind of, in a sense, what our dollar is based off of. And you even talk about how we are a debt-based society and how dangerous that is.
Well, that's a good question. You know, we have a dishonest money system, monetary system. Think about the fact that our every dollar has to be loaned into existence that we have. And in other words, any revenue that the Treasury wants, they have to create a Treasury bond and issue paper money against that. That's a perversion of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, to borrow against the credit of the United States. Well, that's what they've done. So they've created a bond that requires an interest rate on it. And where are they going to get the money to pay the interest on the dollar unless they keep printing more? This is a perpetual system here. And it means there's just going to be more and more inflation and devaluation of the currency. You know, the people talk about inflation like it's like the Fed has a 2% target rate, they said. Well, think about it. You work 50 years, you get 100% of nothing. How fair is that? You know, hey, we're trying to fight that inflation. Inflation is a increase in the money supply. You can have price inflation if you had a bad crop freeze in the orange citrus, you know, in Florida or something. That could cause price to go up. But real inflation is measured by too much money inflation, and it's something that a central bank does. Peter Schiff's a friend of mine, or I love his material. He quoted his father recently, who said that inflation was the silent partner of the United States. I thought about that statement, and it's so true, so concise. We're on this debt-based system since 1913, and if we just don't keep, we have to keep inflating and keep devaluing to keep paying the bonds. And I'm talking, you know, $100 trillion in bonds and everything that can never be paid off. It's going to end badly. And so it's produced a few things: our dishonest system we have, asset bubbles, financial repression. And the Fed was created as to be our lender of last resort. Of course, today it's become the what, buyer of last resort.
Yeah.
They never envisioned that happening, and now that's, you know, it's like a snake eating its tail or something.
Yeah.
You know, and so very Ron Paul talks about this quite a bit. The whole thing is really a confidence game with central banking. In fact, Ben Bernanke was said that the Fed was 98% talk, 2% action. So they're always kind of seeing what the market's gonna, or how it's gonna react, and then they, and if they don't do something, so what? So they could be bluffing about raising rates. Many believe they're gonna have to reverse, go to QE again, you know, and do it that way. You remember the movie It's a Wonderful Life? Everybody sees that. And George Bailey, there he is, the banker, and everybody's coming in for their money, and he says, "Well, your money is over here in Joe's house," and, you know, and everything else, you
Yeah.
know. We should have fiduciary money monetary system. We should have one that's based on fiduciary money. Then the evolution of money is commodity money, fiduciary money, fractional reserve money, and then fiat, that means nothing. So that means we just have nothing right now.
Right.
And that's where we've ended up. There's even a term that's used called bailment. Bailment is like if you're a bailer, it means you're a lender of your, say, your hat at a hat check, and then the bailee takes it in. Well, they cannot have ownership. They can't even use your what you've given them. And that's what a bailment, that's what banking really should be, is based on bailment, not for them to treat it as an asset and liability. They treat it as their asset. They owe it to you, but they're going to lend it out 28 times. Now, if they did on a fractional reserve basis, which is what the goldsmiths did in the Middle Ages, at least there'd be some nominal gold backing. But we've abandoned that completely now since 1933. So this is where we're at. This is what we're stuck with. And in my book, I go into the monetary history. They signed the Gold Act of 1900, and when McKinley did this, he did it with a gold pen. Just to get back at the free silver movement and those who were wanting to have silver as a bimetallism in that era. I go into this in a little report I did on my websites, The Wizard of Oz Allegories, because in the original Wizard of Oz, the Street of Gold represented gold. Oz was ounce for ounce of gold. The Emerald City was green, and Dorothy in the original version had silver slippers. And that was intentional because that's what Frank Baum wanted to create an allegory, was the politics of that era, what was going on. They were fighting to have silver up against gold, to create more quantity of the money supply and help the farmers, which is represented by the scarecrow and so on. It's an interesting allegory, but that was the whole thing going on then. And of course, in the movie version, they put on ruby slippers, so he totally lost the whole meaning. And but anyway, there is a report that people could download on my websites on the Wizard of Oz allegories. I think it's fascinating to see how that really played out. So fundamentally, Samson, money should be a store of value. It's to conserve your capital, your sweat and equity and capital investment. It should hold its value over time. And the money system we have today, it's a dishonest scales are an abomination to God, Proverbs 11:1. You know, and there's another proverb says, the weights in the bag are his concern. Honesty in the monetary system. What we have now is oppressing savers, pensioners, widowers. It's a hidden tax, right? Inflation is a hidden tax. It's stealing from you your purchasing power. So this is exactly where we are. And the banksters, I call them, are very dishonest because they've been net buyers of gold since 2010 after the crisis, which they created. And they're trying to look to recapitalize the banks and so on. So that is a very obviously where things are going, and they're not telling you about that. So even JP Morgan has now acquired 700 million ounces of physical silver. They didn't have any silver in 2011, and now they're aggressively about an annual supply. In fact, more that would be more than their commercial revenue of $100 billion a year if we get $100 silver, which I think we could. Right now, we're at 80-to-1 ratio. It should be 16-to-1. Silver should be $80 an ounce. Gold should be much higher. I think in a monetary reset, it's going to go up considerably. And so that's why I'm in the business I'm in. Right now, business has been off since Trump's been in office. People are very complacent, and they just think everything's going to get better, and I don't buy it. I think we're I think we're just a banking crisis away, you know.
Yeah. Well, we talk about it's hard. How do you fight a system that arguably was intentionally put in place to lead us to this point, going back way to the Civil War when centralized banking was set up, and then the creation of the Federal Reserve and the tax system? Is how do you fight something like that? And you talk about. And one question I always had in regards to metals is you were talking about a potential reset on the dollar and on the financial system. Why is why is precious metal going to be able to maintain its value? To me, it's just something that people say has value, and in reality doesn't really have anything besides what people believe it is, similarly to stocks in a sense. So can you kind of correct me on that?
You're saying how do we attach value to gold and silver?
Yeah, like why is gold valuable? Essentially, isn't it just a collection of what people say it's worth?
Well, it's been money for 5,000 years. Mm-hmm. Silver even, you know, longer than gold in that regard. So it's the only two monetary metals. It's why it was put in the Constitution also to have to stress bimetallism. And so the real value today is being suppressed by the bankers. They're colluding to intervene in the paper markets, futures markets, and that's how they price the metals. And it's not based on fundamentals and supply and demand, which should dictate the price. I think in a reset, we're going to see a tremendous rise in the price of gold, like FDR did in 1933 when he banned gold, or he took gold in at $20 an ounce and then raised it to $35. And he reflated the economy by 75%. That was his version of QE. And that's kind of what has got to happen today. The price will be set by the free market, or someday through delivery defaults and so on, these benchmarks. And I think that China is in a much better position to be doing that. As it is right now, gold and silver is out of favor. Probably 1, maybe 2% of the American people have gold or silver, thinking in this regard. Most people are in the financial markets, fully exposed to capital markets, collapsing. And this also has been created by the Federal Reserve. It was in my one of my last newsletters, was the Plunge Protection Team and how they've boosted up the market. That was created in 1987 to intervene in the marketplace and buy up S&P futures and so on and push the market up. Well, this is how the Fed has done this. That's where QE money has gone to the commercial banks and then to the stockholders, and they're bidding up their price. You can see the increase of the of QE, the money supply, at the same chart with the stock index and so on. So that's not a real market. PE ratios right now are at 26 to 1. That's that. You'd have to go back to 1929 levels to see that. That's how dangerous things are right now. And most insidious of all, I think, is the stock buybacks. You know, we think tax breaks are going to make corporations benevolent and go out and hire people and create jobs. 95% or more is going to dividends or stock buybacks to shrink the pool of shares, increase the price, make shareholders happy, and big bonuses for management and all as well. And you're doing this on margin. You're doing it on margin debt, record margin debt right now, which blew up the market in 1929. They call it a Minsky moment. We're on the same trajectory for this kind of huge collapse, and not just here, probably all markets around the world. They're all very much connected right now. And like I said, people are just too complacent. There's something called the volatility index, the VIX index. And it's just been, the volatility in stocks has just been steady. You know, people are not concerned, you know, and it's really going to hit them. I mean, we've created essentially a wealth effect. We've gone from, I don't know, $56 trillion to $100 trillion in household wealth. That can be lost just as quickly as the subprime real estate mm-hmm. was lost. Back then, you know, so.
Yeah, especially when we're, you know, based on nothing, when our money's based on nothing, it can just disappear into nothing. And to kind of go back into the idea of the debt-based society, something that you talk about is the Trifon's dilemma. Did I say that right? The Trifon's dilemma. Can you explain mm-hmm. what that is?
Yeah, Robert Trifon, he was an economist, a Belgian economist. He worked at the New York Fed and also the IMF and so on. In 1961, he was working, professor at Yale, and he issued a paper now known as Trifon's Dilemma, Robert Trifon, because he was saying that the nation that issues the reserve currency of the world, which we have done since 1944, is fatally flawed, he said. In order to supply the world with money, we'd have to go into huge inflation and run trade deficits. And that's what we're doing today. Right? You hear a lot of people talking about trade deficits. Well, that's built into the whole reserve currency, dynamic that we have today. Anyway, and this was going to lead to the devaluing of the dollar and erode the confidence in the dollar. How do you maintain confidence in the dollar at the same time you're eroding it? Sorry, Sam, I'm getting a little bit
No, it's okay. You get choked
dry
up. You
here.
get choked up when you talk about debt and stuff like that. No, I'm just kidding. And so, is my summary of it correct? So basically, since you have to supply the world with currency, you have to put more currency out than the currency that you take in because you have to supply more markets with your currency. Therefore, it will automatically be a trade deficit.
There always will be because 60% of reserves are in dollars, 80% of commerce is in dollars. So the world needs it. They need it to intervene in their own currency markets and so on. The petrodollar recycling had a lot to do with that, which I talked about in the past. But that's where we're at. In fact, that's and to maintain confidence in the dollar. In the post-Bretton Woods period, they created the London Gold Pool in 1961. Now, this was eight banks, central banks, and they were conspiring to dump gold at times in order to keep the price down, keep it a fixed rate of convertibility. It was $35 an ounce for gold, and that was 35 paper dollars. So that had to be maintained because foreigners could redeem their foreign dollars for gold. That replaced the gold standard. Or that was like a gold standard. And so in 1971, Nixon closed the gold window because of foreign pressure. They were dumping more, there was more currency offshore than there was gold in reserves. And that was due to the Vietnam War and the Great Society spending and welfare and everything else. So the French and OPEC and others were really leaning on the US. And finally, Nixon said, we're going to temporarily suspend. Decouple the gold from the US dollars. And of course, that was not temporary. We've been on a fiat currency system for what, 47 years now, and they usually last about 40 years. So we're due for every fiat currency in history has failed. And now we're talking the reserve currency of the world failing. That we have never, seen anything quite like this. I think, in fact, when that happened, you could almost call that a delivery default of gold. We failed to deliver on that promise. And this is what the warehouses and exchanges are going to run into someday when there's so much gold and silver demand, they're going to have delivery defaults. Right now, it's a paper derivatives. There's 150 paper contracts for every ounce of silver at COMEX in New York. That's not a real market. That can't be maintained. There's even as high as 500 in the gold market. So, that's very dishonest pricing mechanism. We need a genuine price discovery for gold and silver, and someday I believe it's going to be the largest transfer of wealth in human history for people who have precious metals today. And silver is the poor man's gold. I think it has the most upside potential. Personally, I have more silver than gold, just because of the way, because of what I know about this marketplace and so on. So anyway, that's kind of where I see things heading. So what's the solution for Triffin's dilemma? The solution is to not have a single reserve currency, but to have a multi-currency. And in this regard, in 2009, at the G20 meeting, the Chinese met or put out a paper, and they said they wanted to reform the international monetary system and create a new international reserve currency that is disconnected from an individual nation. Of course, they were talking about the US. So I'd say that we've gone from a financial crisis on Wall Street to an economic crisis and now to a monetary crisis. Now to we're questioning the very value of money. And where do we go from here with the US? This is what the French called an exorbitant privilege to issue the reserve currency. We would have been broke, collapsed. We'd have been Venezuela years ago. We would have been Greece. We'd be Italy if we didn't have, by default, the central bank of the world, the Federal Reserve. But that's how it was set up in Jekyll Island. It was a conspiracy. It was done in private, and it was meant to serve the bankers, not the people. And that's, the love of money is the root of all evil. These are the money changers. These are the same people who killed our Lord. They're still with us. That's why I call them the money changers in my book. So anyway, back in 2009, they increased the SDR allocation after the last crisis, and they're anticipating to raise that up to, higher levels. Even the Bank of International Settlements in Basel has dropped the Swiss franc and is using the SDR as a unit of account internally. What there that tells you that we're heading towards a special drawing right, which was introduced, in 1969, and again in 2002, and now we see that there's five currencies in there, five basket currencies: the U.S., the euro, the yuan, the yen, and the pound. China was just added after petitioning for almost 10 years in 2016. So now they've legitimized their economy. They're the largest economy based on purchasing power parity. Second is Europe, and then third is the U.S. We think we're the biggest economy. We think we're the greatest, I what this is suggesting is a move out of, I see U.S. bonds eventually could be even converted to SDR bonds. This would be issued through the IMF and so on. And again, they're increasing these allocations. These are the things going on behind the scenes. There needs to be a debt jubilee. The Bible, speaks about that, Leviticus 25. And it was a jubilee to let the land have a rest every 50 years, I guess, right? And that, so that's kind of what they're calling this, a debt forgiveness. Look, 12 zeros, $1 trillion, you can never repay this debt. It can never be done. We cannot grow ourselves out of this hole we're in. Will Rogers once said, when you find yourself in a hole, you should quit digging. So I think my last newsletter, which I sent you, showed a cover by William Middlecoop. He wrote the book, The Big Reset. And he says that a monetary reset will be well planned in advance, or it'll be hastily implemented on the back of a dollar collapse crisis situation. You know how they love crisis, right?
Yeah.
Never want a
Never
good
waste
crisis.
one.
Never want to waste one. So it's kind of how Jim Rickards often refers to the monetary system as an avalanche, building up more and more snow, more and more debt. And then finally, it just someday it destroys everything in its path. And in this case, it'll be capital markets, people's 401k, their quarterly statements, pensions. I don't know, man. My generation is not prepared for this. They're not. It's very hard for me to find people that have a real grip on this.
Yeah,
And
just to jump in real quick, what you laid out there was basically our economy is essentially made up on nothing. It's made up on debt. It's easily controlled by the central bankers and the Federal Reserve. It's too confusing to understand based on the tax plan that we have in place and all the different rules and levels that you have to go through. And it's set up so people are easily. So it's set up to create a world financial system where people are more easily controlled and more dependent on the government, which to me sounds exactly like what they want. So why would they lead us to a financial collapse? How does that benefit the central bankers and the Federal Reserve?
Well, they're out of control. They're out of bullets. They're out of dry powder. They don't have plan B. This is their plan B. And it's going to happen in the bond market, going no bid, collapsing credit worthiness. Right now, China has downgraded U.S. bonds to triple B. That was January 16th of this year. You didn't hear about that anywhere. And of course, the rating cartel in New York thinks that, well, that's just the Chinese. Who cares about them? Well, they happen to be our bankers. They're holding $1.1 trillion in bonds and almost $3 trillion in currency. Think about that. So they have often called for a de-Americanized world. So the globalists, the IMF, they're trying to get a solution, find a solution for the Triffin's dilemma.
So you're almost saying that this collapse and reset is a good thing.
And it's going to create a political paradigm shift where the U.S. is going to go into decline. We cannot depend on loose fiscal policy anymore. Our bond markets are going to go triple B. we're going to have to produce things, but we've offshored and exported all of our manufacturing and everything. We just don't make stuff anymore. I was going to get into financialization of the economy, which is a it's been happening since the 1980s. It used to be that 5-10% of the economic activity was financial services related. Well, now it's about 50%. It's a casino out there. I mean, they're rigging the markets, front running dark pools, algorithms, algo trading. They're in, derivatives. They've created all this exotic hazard out there. And so I think they're going to lose control. And the only reason they're trying to keep stocks up, because that's a metric that is at least providing some yield. And but that's going to, and when that happens here, I don't know, could happen in Europe, could happen in Japan. Right now there's talk about adding gold to the SDR basket currency, which I think they really have to do. But they are not. A lot of people are saying that the Chinese probably have about 20,000 tons of gold. Think of that. Europe has around 12,000. We say we have 8,000 at Fort Knox. I really don't believe that. But they're suggesting to restore confidence in the system, again, they're going to have to put gold component into the SDR, which would probably be 20% or something like that. The IMF rules, Article 4, Section 2, don't allow members to have a gold-backed currency. So this means China is not getting all this gold to back their currency. Some say they're going to be the new reserve currency of the world. No, they're not. They're too new to this game. I think this is going to, shift to the European theater in a large way. But what we are seeing today is Gresham's Law working out, that bad money drives out good money. And this is why they need gold in the banking system to recapitalize it, again, to restore confidence. You know, think about that. That's the only thing that's holding things up. If people knew, Henry Ford, I think, said, if people knew how corrupt the monetary system was, there'd be a revolution in the morning. And it's not just confidence. I call it ignorance, because if they really knew the facts, they wouldn't have too much confidence in it at all. And if we, incidentally, if we see $20,000 gold, which many are calling for and higher, at a 15, even 30 to 1 ratio on silver, you're going to see silver take off into the hundreds, I think. It could very well happen. Just think of that. So even further now, the Chinese have introduced the petro yuan and backed it with a gold contract. So you can see what they're doing. They're very stealthy about this. And they're trying to create alliances with Russia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the New Silk Road, the Eurasian Economic Union, right? These gas and pipelines. You can see it all coming to a point where I think America is going to be isolated on the world stage in such a way. And we can get into prophecy a little bit later, but in a minute here, because America is really not portrayed as playing a very big role in the last days in prophecy. So that's something to think about.
Yeah, we can definitely get into that in a second. What you just said was these alliances for me. You almost see like three kind of powers starting to form in the economic system, which what you brought up in your book, even talking about George Orwell's book in 1984, to create this constant warfare and pressure on each other to make people remain in chaos and disorder. Would those be those kind of the three powers you see forming?
Yeah, I tie that into the Trilateral Commission even. That's the Trilateral Commission talked about three spheres of influence in the world, very similar to what Orwell had outlined, Eurasia and Oceania and things like that. And that would include the European Union. There's a movement towards a North American Union. I still keep that in my book because that is still relevant, even though Trump says he's trying to build a wall. I don't think he's got the memo that they want to merge us with Canada and Mexico.
Right.
That's their globalist endgame, progressive regionalization. This is what Brzezinski talked about many times as the head of the Trilateral Commission. So that's kind of where they even call it now the Eurasian group. They call them groups now on the Trilateral Commission homepage. So I see that turning into reality. Of course, the European Union is way down the road here right now. Brzezinski wrote a book He wrote a book called The Great Game, and he said the landmass in Eurasia is the most important landmass, 40% of the population, natural resources, and everything else. So it's really big changes are underway. Napoleon said when China wakes, she's going to shake the world. I think the real shakeup's going to be when the European Union wakes up as a new world superpower.
Well, I can definitely see it coming. Got to keep people against each other, divided and conquered. So that's what we need. So I did it. So as we kind of transition into the world of prophecy and things like that, I did have a guest reach out. I try to let my audience know who's coming on the show. It gives them the opportunity to ask guests. And with the recent, and talking about more of recent prophecy, I guess, or people coming out and saying that Trump's kind of changing the way America is being run, and that maybe God's coming back into our society, and you can see movements of Christianity being implemented in more areas. Do you feel like that we're going to be able to get turn us more directly towards God so that He will save us from this mess?
I don't. The Bible says that evil men are going to get worse and worse. 1 Timothy 3, and the last days, difficult times will come, and so on. Jesus said in Luke 18, "When I return, will I find faith on the earth?" And the Greek mood is implies really no. I don't see a great revival. I see judgment coming to our country. Billy Graham once said, "If God doesn't punish America, he owes an apology to Sodom and Gomorrah." Well, we become the culture wars. I mean, you see it every day, the moral decline. So I don't really see that. I think again, like I said, you could just see it in the crowds voting for Trump. There was worry, anxiety, distress. Like we've had 8 years of Obama and the progressives, and we need to get back to the good old days of Ronald Reagan. And it was Reagan who said, if a nation doesn't have borders, it's no longer a nation. And that's so we're just trying to. So a lot of people are putting their hopes on Trump. A lot of people refer to consumer confidence indexes, which I consider opinion polls, which is kind of like jaywalking with Jay Leno. It's really not based in the hard data, the statistics, structural unemployment, velocity of money, paycheck to paycheck, things like this that we're seeing. The real economy out there. And so it's a lot of income inequality. What Trump has released is the animal spirits. That's what John Maynard Keynes called it. Just this idea that everybody's buying, so I'm going to buy, or I feel good, so we're going to feel good. Not really based on that. I don't, again, see a very big role for the U.S. in the last days. The U.S. is in worse shape than the EU in many ways. They have an aging demographic like we do, but nothing on the scale of the U.S., nothing on the amount of debt pyramid and so on. And they're worse in six ways. The U.S. debt here is $21 trillion. That's just what we admit to, compared to about 12, 12.5 trillion in the Eurozone or Europe. That's about 80% debt to GDP. So you can see they're in a little bit better shape. We run these perpetual trade deficits. They have a balance of trade. They even have a surplus of trade. So the household debt is 65% of the GDP. It's only around 50% in the EU. They have a much higher savings rate. Their unemployment is half of what ours is, unemployment, and they have considerably more gold, tons of gold, than we do to really restructure debt in a jubilee of some kind. That they would come out a little bit higher. The Bible even predicts the rise of Europe in the last days, and we'll get into that in a minute. But the problem in Europe right now, and I go into this in my book quite a bit, that the euro was launched in 1999, and the Eurozone has 19 members. But as Milton Friedman said, one size does not fit all. You've got weaker nations in there, stronger ones. And things have worked right up until about 2008. Then it exposed the weakness. And in 2012, they created what they call the European Stability Mechanism to create a firewall and protect the Eurozone and everything. What they really need, a solution there, is they have a monetary union, which they forced, first of all, not even a political union, but they really need a fiscal union, is what they need in Europe. And they need a centralized policy, and pretty much like the Fed operates. Right now, it's kind of loosely organized around the ECB. They issue their own bonds. They need to issue a common bond within the Eurozone or Europe collectively. And this is exactly what they're planning. There was a study done 3 years ago called the Five Presidents Report of the institutions in Europe. And what they are, what they want to promote over there is the they want to replace this the stability mechanism with a new European Fiscal Institute. This would be very much like our, say, our Treasury Department or something. And they would be the fiscal agent for the Eurozone and then issuing stability bonds. That's what they call them. And that would provide stability. They would appoint a Treasury Minister. And all these things are in the works since the Lisbon Treaty of 2009. So they're really moving in this direction. And I find it fascinating. I love to study this development because I think it fits into a prophecy where they're going to be rising up as a leader in the world. In fact, it was even Jim Rickards in his book, Death of Money, he said the EU is destined to evolve into the world's economic superpower. The Eurobonds will provide a deep liquid pool of investable assets larger than the U.S. Treasury bond market. So he sees something. We traded books a couple of years ago, and I hope he gets into my book. I don't know that I don't know if he knows what he is saying there, but he's saying something very prophetic, I think. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, we got about 10 or so minutes left. Was there anything? There's a lot more that you talk about in your book. And again, it's all kind of like it's very much like the way you speak, laid out by different facts and quotes and historical context to understand where we're at today. So I definitely urge everyone to grab a copy of it and read it. So what was it? We have about 10 minutes left. Was there things that we weren't able to cover that you find really crucial to cover?
Well, maybe next time we should get into Daniel's prophecy and things like that, mm-hmm. and the rapture and ufology and the Vatican and what I see as a global world religion, a spiritual paradigm shift. Those mm-hmm. are all things that are developed in my book, Chapter 6. So I really
yeah. You can't cover all those in 10 minutes?
No. I'm giving you the good part. I've set you up pretty good here.
Yeah.
I would recommend that people get my newsletter, free newsletter. Put in your name and email at my either website, chuckhoppus.com or idpconsultinggroup.com. Of course, if I can help you in precious metals, let me know. But this recognition of Jerusalem, for example, what Zechariah 12:3 says that in the last days, I'm going to make Jerusalem a heavy stone, and all who lift it up will be severely injured. All the nations around it said, well, that's all you hear in the UN is condemnation of Israel. And yet Tom Horn recently said that Trump has kind of invigorated a messianic era among the Orthodox over in Israel. They're naming a street after him. And the Temple Institute is making the vessels, they're in reinvigorated. Revelation 11 assumes the existence, the rebuilding of a third temple in literal, and that is what Trump has done recently in that regard is setting things up, but it's also setting things up for war in the Middle East. And that's everything's right there in Syria. You got Russia, you got Iran. Ezekiel 38:5 mentions Persia, which changed its name to Iran in what, 1936. So that's it's right on the border of Israel that there's going to be this Russian Arab alliance and so on come against Israel, and of course it'll be a major conflict. Israel will survive by the grace of God and His protection, but that's all. The players are all there right now, and of course Syria is a real mess. It's mostly based on the LNG pipelines and who gets the market to Europe, whether it's going to be Qatar, Saudi Arabia, or Russia and Iran. So you're pitting these groups over money and sectarianism like the Sunnis and Shiites. So it gets really, the Middle East gets very complicated, let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we kind of wrap up our conversation, can you end us on a note of hope? Because it can be very Downing to talk about the potential collapse of a financial system. But in reality, as Christians, we are not dependent on the worldly systems that we inhabit. So can you end us on some hope, that, like you do in your book?
Sure. I mean, if it weren't for my faith in the Lord that grounds me, it would be a pretty crazy world, pretty negative news cycle and everything else. But I'm just trying to be the messenger and see where things are going. You know, God has never promised a smooth flight in this life, just a safe landing. And we're going to have some turbulence, you know. Paul said, 2 Timothy 3:1, in the last days, perilous, difficult times will come. So I devote a chapter in my book, chapter 7, just on presenting the good news and the darkest hours before the dawn. But, you know, we're going to win in the end. That is a hopeful. We know that the Bible says stronger is he that's in us than he that's in the world. We're in a battle between good and evil, and good is going to win out in the end. We really need a Christian worldview to answer life's three big questions, and that is, where did I come from, why am I here, and where am I going? And every person needs to think about that. That's a worldview. If you think we just evolve and we're here for nothing and you're just here to exploit people and then die someday, that's a secular humanist worldview. That's very unfulfilling. Jesus said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by his word, by the Spirit. And we're here to know God as our creator and have faith in his son and have eternal life in heaven. So that's the good news we share. There is a link on my website, IDP website, for the good news, and invite people to go there and take a look at that. That's, you got to get the bad news before you can get the good news, know, and that's kind of where we're at, but it's pretty simple. I mean, the Christmas story is one in which God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son. Whoever believes in him should not perish. The Easter story is the power of the resurrection and changed lives like mine, like yours. And the Apostle Paul, I mean, that's, to me, that's the biggest apologetic value, example, I guess we could have, is the Apostle Paul. He was killing Christians, and then he goes on to write 13 books in the New Testament. So, yeah, he was profoundly converted. That's the good news, and that we pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So someday it's God's going to bring around his new world order, and of course that's the only new world order that I want to submit to. It'll be a benevolent theocracy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate coming on the show. What you said was so true. Got to put our faith in God. Where, and I know you said this a little bit already, but where can people buy your book? Where can they find you? What do you have coming up in the future?
Well, again, I put out a newsletter every month, about 20 pages, kind of in depth. And you can get a copy of my book if they go to chuckhoppus.com. And that I would send a two-hour DVD PowerPoint I did at a local church in Phoenix, and special report and so on. I'll be glad to send that out. So that's where they can go to Amazon as well. Amazon orders are there. I signed the copies here from my office. And again, if they go to my website, they might take a look at some of the downloads I have there and so on. You know, we're facing a reckoning day, and the bankers know it. And so I'm trying to help people get into precious metals at these artificially suppressed prices for 7 long years. Something's going to break out here. And if I can help people in that regard, if they have IRA accounts, qualified plans, we can move it into precious metals and do things like that. So, yeah, give me a call. Or my toll-free number is on my site and everything else. And it's time to be prepared. That's all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate coming on the show. What you said was very informative, so thank you.
Yeah, good to be with you, Sam. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. Well, guys, that's our show this week. Remember, it says in Scripture, it doesn't matter who's going to come against us if God is for us. And no matter what we face when it comes into the economical struggles that we face, or the world structures, or the banking systems, or anything you face in your day-to-day life, if you put your faith in God, he has the power to turn it for good. And that's what we're calling for. So if we can break this, if we can get back to a moral structure and a moral society, we will be able to weather the storm, whatever that may be, whether it be a financial collapse or whether it just be a few more tough years of politics. Either way, we're going to be able to weather it and get through it because our faith and our dependence is on the proper things. It's not on the government. It's on the way that God made us. It's in God, and it's in our own individual skill sets that God has given us. And that's what we need to strive for, and that's what we need to push for. Guys, I'm not going to ask you to like, subscribe, or share, but you know I appreciate it if you do. Make sure you pick up Chuck's book. It is fantastic, and it has a lot more detail into it. Guys, I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope that you have a great week.